Sexy and Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR.
Welcome to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you could be one of our podcast listeners. However you've decided to spend the hour with us, we are very, very glad to have you. As you know, the Fringe Festival is up, it's thriving, and it is going from September the 5th to the 15th. And in the last couple of weeks, I've had different guests from different fringes on the show, which has been wonderful. And I'm very excited to have an amazing man in here. For those of you who like to get a little bit of a thrill, want to know a little bit more about stuff that's a little bit who am I kidding? It's a lot scary, especially to me personally. Jack the Ripper, which is playing at the Vancouver East Cultural Center, and he is here. He is known as a ripperologist. You may have seen him at the Vancouver Public Library because he was just doing a lecture just last week, if I recall correctly. As well as that, you may have read his book, the first Jack the Ripper victim photographs. If you haven't figured out who I'm talking about yet, you're going to hear his voice. You might recognize his voice right away, but I will not keep you in suspense because I'm going to tell you who it is. It is Robert J. McLaughlin. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here, Caroline.
Thank you. So tell me a little bit about, just in terms of, let's just go over the logistics first for the play, because sure. You've just opened on, I believe it was on the 6th?
Yeah, we opened on the 6th, yeah, Friday.
And how many more? There's 6 performances altogether, isn't there, for the run?
Yeah, we have 2 more to go. We still have Friday the 13th performance,
which,
I'm sure a lot of people will come out for that one, just because of the date. It's also an evening performance, so Friday night is always great.
Okay.
And then we close up Sunday.
That's exciting, and it's neat that you've got a lot of the weekend ones as well.
Oh, it's always good to have a weekend show, especially at the end of the festival if people are trying to see your show. And
very true. But you've also had some really great coverage as well, because you guys were on the lovely Terry Lynn story was on the front cover of the George Strait last week, which was lovely to see.
Yeah, it was wonderful, for Terry Lynn and I getting on the cover of the Strait. And it was kind of interesting, actually, being noticed by a few people as well, I quite enjoyed that a little bit.
That's awesome. So tell me a little bit about just all, because you've been researching as a ripperologist?
Yeah, ripperologist.
I love that word, ripperologist. How did you get involved, like, in terms of the curiosity, and how has it shifted over the years?
Basically, I was just a precocious child. And I mean, when other kids were reading comic books, I was reading true crime magazines. I probably first heard about Jack the Ripper when I was about 14 years old, and just sort of an interest, because I used to read books about, you know, Old West outlaws, American gangsters from the 20s and 30s, and all of that kind of thing that I was interested in. And gradually over time, like when I got into my 20s, I started doing writing as a living. And, I was still interested in Jack the Ripper, but it wasn't until I actually started doing my own research on the case that I became a bit more deeply involved in it. Just trying to figure out a few things for myself. And then one thing led to another, and then you meet other people who know a lot about the subject, and before you know it, you're writing articles, or you're writing a book, or speaking at conferences or whatever. And it's just a fascinating, unsolved mystery.
It's a scary one. And I know there's been so many different movies, etc., and there's so much information out there. So what is your personal theory?
Most people ask me that. I don't think we know the identity of Jack the Ripper. Okay. Police at the time, they had lots of different views, all differing views, and what you see usually in Hollywood, like, let's say, from the Johnny Depp movie From Hell, is usually a romanticized version of it. It's, usually involving, like, royal family or Freemasons, and something that's very conspiratorial, but it makes for an interesting film, but it's not entirely that accurate. I liken it to, hey, if I told you that Prince William was, in his spare time from Princess, Kate, you know, running around killing women in London, you'd think I was, you know, being ridiculous. And but it's sort of the same thing saying that Queen Victoria's grandson was doing the same thing, you know, so.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since he had an alibi for...
For the time.
Yeah, for 4 of the 5 nights. And his movements are well charted, unlike, let's say, you know, those unknown people that we don't really know about from night to night. That mm-hmm. we can't track them through newspapers and royal records and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. For those who are not familiar with the Jack the Ripper case, in like less than 500 words, would you be able to kind of just
sure.
the key points? Because it was, I believe, 1888 London.
It was 1888 London, exactly 125 years ago.
Wow.
We're actually right in the midst of that. We performed on the death of the 125th anniversary death of Annie Chapman, one of the victims of Jack the Ripper. The Whitechapel murders, they occurred from 88 through 91. There were 11 victims in the file. Nobody believes that all those victims were attributed to Jack the Ripper,
mm-hmm.
Because we don't really know for sure how many he killed. Probably at least 4, maybe 6, possibly as many as 8. He picked vulnerable women. These women were either casual prostitutes or full-time prostitutes. And he murdered them outdoors. He asphyxiated them and then, you know, would disembowel them, sometimes removing organs. And it was very brutal. And like I said, doing it outdoors, leaving them in the streets. And London at the time was, you know, the most populous city in the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
It was twice as large as Paris, 3 times as large as New York City. And there were almost 5 million people living in London in 1888. And the police were doing everything they could to find him. They were putting extra resources on the streets, knocking on a lot of doors. They were hampered, of course, by limited forensic techniques at the time, but also they were dealing with a killer that, you know, they were used to domestic killings or, you know, a punch-up in a bar ending in death, somebody pulling out a knife, but this was something entirely new to them. They didn't really understand it. And even in modern times, we're not really that much better
mm-mm.
at catching serial killers now. I mean, it still takes time. But it basically occurred between August and November of 1888, the big scare. The case went on after 88. There were a couple murders. Most people didn't think it was Jack. And eventually the case was shelved in 1892 without anyone being arrested for the crimes.
Wow. And I believe it's 4 or 5 that they thought were linked, and that was because they were killed very similar, wasn't it? Where at one point there was a theory that they thought it was either Butcher, which if I remember correctly, Butcher back then was the name for a doctor?
No, Butcher
actually was
a
doctor. Okay.
Butcher was a butcher. But they had lots of theories floating around. They had, you know, they thought it could have been a doctor, could have been a disbarred doctor, could have been a disgruntled veterinary student, could have been a mortuary attendant, could have been a butcher,
mm-hmm.
Could have been just somebody lodging and kept weird hours, could have been a lunatic. After a while, like as the case grew in the public's mind and the fear heightened, it sort of everybody became a suspect. I mean, the focus at the beginning was sort of very narrow, and then they had to broaden it out
mm-hmm.
as, you know, as more killings happened, more witnesses came forward, and the case gets, you know, extremely complex. And the reason why, yeah, they link about 5 murders together is because it happened in a very relatively short period of time. Like I said, over basically just a 3-month period.
Wow. That's a lot of murders, and especially with 5 million people in the city, where it's just like, how do they go missing? And just even like just getting killed like that when there's so many people around.
Exactly, and in a relatively small area.
Mm-hmm. It was Whitecastle, wasn't it?
Whitechapel. And the killing area was basically, you know, about less than 1 square mile. It was a very small area that he was murdering for the most part. One murder of Annie Chapman in Hanbury Street, in a backyard in Hanbury Street, occurred while it was light out just before dawn. Anyone who looked out their window could have saw him in the backyard. A man next door came out to use the bathroom and heard a knock against the fence and the word no, but he never looked over the fence. If he did, he could have saw Jack the Ripper cutting up Annie Chapman. But so yeah, he came close to being caught many times just because of the nature. But he was a risk taker, as I mean, a lot of serial killers are.
Mm-hmm. What's your theory about the letters that were to the press? Do you think they were hoaxes, or do you think they're any of them were legitimately from him?
I think the letters actually signed Jack the Ripper are not written by the killer we know as Jack the Ripper. I think those the original name was a journalistic hoax, journalistic invention that caught on with the public, because before the name of Jack the Ripper, he was known as the Whitechapel Murderer or Leather Apron in the press. And then when the Jack the Ripper name came out in a Dear Boss letter, then the name stuck in the minds of the public.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one possible letter that I take that might be from the Ripper, and that was included with half a human kidney that was sent to a man named George Lesk, who was head of the Vigilance Committee. And they just patrolled the streets and, you know, tried to basically help the police and be an extra set of eyes and gather information.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a letter along with half a human kidney. And the letter was, you know, quite disturbing. But at the time, there was no pathological test that could link the kidney to Catherine Eddowes, who was missing a kidney, who the Ripper had removed a kidney from. But yeah, there are possible letters that he may have written, but it even after so long, it's hard to know which ones. It might not even be that. It could be some innocuous letter. And I don't even know if he was literate or spoke English.
That's a good point, especially back then, because there were a lot of people who had come over from Ireland as well, and a lot of immigrants in the area, was there not?
Not unlike today. I mean, East End of London is still an immigrant community. It's just the faces have changed. They're from Southeast Asia now, for the most part. But back in 1888, they were fleeing persecution and the pogroms of Eastern Europe, especially the Jews.
Hmm.
The Irish were fleeing the famines back home. And they all ended up in the East End.
Wow. I think in North America, we've got a fascination with serial killers. What makes a serial killer, like, just in terms of, I look at, in Vancouver, we've got, of course, Robert Picton and the downtown east side, which in some ways I almost compare and contrast a little bit because there were so many women who were murdered. Vancouver's a pretty busy city.
Yes, it is.
And same thing where it took a very long time for things to link up, as well as just people were appalled. But I can still remember back in 2000 before the first pictures of some of the victims were in the paper about the DNA found out on the pig farm, that there were just a lot of social attitudes where if people would make jokes about prostitution, addiction, etc., where I think in Vancouver we've grown up a lot and shifted and developed more compassion and more understanding about that. But there were, I almost think of the grounds as very similar, which it's interesting where that was in 1888 and this was basically like around 2000 before then too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's certainly a lot of parallels between London of 1888 and, you know, modern day Vancouver, which Robert Picton was working from.
Mm-hmm.
You've got like a densely packed city, people living very close to one another. You have a murderer, you know, that nobody knows, that everybody's trying to find. And when people go missing or bodies turn up, then cases become extremely complicated. The more bodies you get, the more witnesses you get, the more people coming forward with information, and then you have to pursue all those leads.
Mm.
I mean, if you're just dealing, let's say, with a singular murder, you have like a limited amount of witnesses, you only have one scene to deal with. It's sort of easier to process all of that information.
Hmm.
You talk to, let's say, a handful of people. You've got, like, maybe the living room crime scene where it happened or wherever it happened. And
mm-hmm.
But then the nature of serial killers is that you have, you know, multiple scenes and multiple witnesses, and you've got to talk to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to follow every lead no matter what, and it becomes really difficult for police. And By the very nature, what the women do, whether it be in Victorian London or modern-day Vancouver, is very secretive. You know, they lead to men to dark corners where they do not want to be seen, you know, performing like a sexual act. And because of that, it puts them at, you know, high risk.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if, you know, these women are usually snatched in front of like 100 witnesses. Usually they go some fair place, very private, and then they're gone. And so, yeah, I mean, serial killers operate, I think, over time in a variety of different ways. They operate very similarly. And they always look for vulnerable people as well, right? In Jack the Ripper's time, he was looking for older women. Most of them were older. They were a bit more broken down. They had problems with alcohol. And not unlike the east side, where they have problems, you know, with crack or heroin or,
mm-hmm.
or things like that. And once again, you know, they physically they probably don't have the strength to fight back, even if, you know, if they get into a vulnerable or difficult situation.
So a lot of it, is it about power, or in terms of as a serial killer?
I think it probably depends on the serial killer itself, because serial killers tend to be, like, by very nature, selfish. It's all about them. You know, I remember reading about one guy in particular, and I can't remember his name, but he was cooking dinner one night, and he just decided to go out and kill a woman, which he did. And he came home, and he discovered that his dinner was burned. And what upset him was that he burned his dinner, not the fact that he'd killed anybody when he was later caught. You know, so I think that type of thing tells you a lot,
mm-hmm.
about it. They're more concerned really about themselves than other people.
Wow. So very sociopathic as well as...
Yeah, some are sociopaths, some are psychopaths. Yeah, psychopaths, you know, tend to be, you know, more introverted, have trouble, you know, with society. They can always disassociate from victims.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of float through. They try not to be seen. They don't really interact with people. Sociopaths tend to be a little bit different. Sociopaths can sometimes appear very normal. You know, they can carry on a normal conversation, maybe even have a menial job, interact with other people, and, you know, oftentimes they're called, oh, he was such a quiet neighbor, right?
Mm.
You hear that all the time. You know, people like Jeffrey Dahmer or others. And so, yeah, I think serial killers, just like a lot of other people, just tend to be very complex, but it's really very, very much about themselves.
Hmm. I was just thinking of Ted Bundy as well, who was actually really, like, I imagine just from watching, like, just a lot of the YouTube videos, just seemed very charismatic.
He was very charismatic and... also very good looking.
Yes.
And, you know, women probably, he looks harmless, right? And sometimes he would also wear a fake cast and get women to help him, like, put something in his vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he would...
had to grab them.
Yeah.
Even with the Clifford Olson case, although that was more for children. And it wasn't until they took one young boy, who I believe was about 11 at the time, where they realized that there was a pattern. Because a lot of the other kids were about 15 to about 18 years old at that point that had gone missing. Where, again, I guess I'm going to go full circle here. It's kind of like the sex workers, where sometimes people don't, you know, they just figure they just disappeared where they left off. Like with the kids, they ran away. With the sex workers, maybe they just left the lifestyle. And so sometimes it takes a while for somebody to say that they're missing unless they actually find the body.
That's true. I mean, exactly. You know, they're a missing case until a body turns up. I mean, it's not a murder investigation. And as you said, they may very well, you know, just be somewhere else and show up.
Mm-hmm.
Which also makes it difficult, you know, to try to investigate something like that.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody disappears, you don't really know where they are or why they're gone. Could be innocent and it might not be.
That's very true, because I know even with the Picton case, there were a few of there. I know for just I've had another guest on my show, and I don't know if I should be saying this on the record or off the record, but actually I will say it. Yes, the wonderful Dave Dixon, who used to be the sex trade liaison for the Vancouver Police Department, where there were a couple women who they actually did find, but did not want their families or anybody to know because they had left the lifestyle and had started fresh and were living elsewhere, which always made me happy to hear those stories, even though he wouldn't tell me who. But right. it was really nice to know where it's like, okay, somebody's made a massive shift. But and at the same time made me think, wow, you know, where how horrific was life, where they felt it was better just to let everybody think that they were missing or dead, as opposed to just saying, hey, fresh start. I don't want to deal with. I'd so love to be able to go back into time and actually be able to go through the police files, like for maybe about 5 or 10 years before the Ripper case.
Yeah, it would be, you know, fascinating thing to mm-hmm. do. Absolutely.
Because sometimes they do escalate, don't they? Where they'll start off with something smaller. I know for some cases. It sometimes starts with cruelty to animals in childhood and starts to escalate from there.
Yeah, there are lots of factors that it can start with. And and lots of people have also, you know, they've looked sort of before 1888 at crimes, you know, trying to see, hey, does anything look like it might be, lead to an, let's say, an immature Ripper-style killing.
Mm.
And then they look at things past 1888 as well.
To see how it's evolved.
To see if there are killings after that point. But nobody's really been able to
link it.
Things. Yeah, exactly. And if he did move or was mobile, like either before or after 1888, then it really does make it difficult, searching those things, like trying to search and hunt down every single record. Especially since at the time there was lots of inaccuracies in journalism. A lot of the point back in 1880 was, hey, let's sensationalize the story. And so, yeah, you might get one version in the newspaper, and then when you dig a little bit deeper into, like, other records, such as, post-mortem reports or doctor reports or police reports, then you find a little bit different story.
Yeah. How has your evolution, because I know in 2003 you published the book, how has it evolved? And now you've got the play, but in between there and even before there, have there been other Jack the Ripper projects that you've done?
In between, I was, researching other things. I was, I spoke at several conferences. And my research continues. Lots of people have wanted a second edition of the book. Which, you know, I would like to tell people that there's a second edition of the book coming, and hopefully that will come, you know, soon for people. I get asked about it all the time, and 'cause mine's sort of a specialist book. It doesn't really aim to solve the case, but I take a look at the photographs, which is really about the only forensic evidence we have left, and I detail the history behind the photographer and the photographs. And that in itself is quite fascinating. It tells us quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because as far as I like it is known to me anyway, the Jack the Ripper case was the first use of forensic photography. I've not found an older case than 1888 that actually took forensic photographs. People photographed dead bodies routinely, but it was usually for identification purposes. Or sometimes you see those shots with Old West bad guys where, people are standing beside them like, yeah, we got him. But not actual forensic crime scene photography, which in 1888, with the murder of Mary Kelly, who was murdered indoors, the police actually sealed it off, treated it like a crime scene, which was very unusual at the time. They preserved the state of the room, they had tested bloodhounds, and they were hoping that bloodhounds were coming, so nobody entered the room because they wanted to give the bloodhounds a chance.
Mm-hmm.
The bloodhounds weren't available. They never did come. But they also called a photographer. He took, multiple photographs from different angles, which, like I said, at the time was very unique.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really see forensic photography develop until the French really did it with Alphonse Bertillon in the 1890s in Paris. He was sort of the pioneer of that. And then it sort of spread throughout the world.
Wow.
People started using the power of photography to help solve crime.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead of like trying to remember what a crime scene looked like, you could actually look at the photos.
Yeah.
Which was very helpful.
I can imagine. How has it been, just in terms of writing the play and working with Terry Lynn as well with the co-creation? We're actually literally getting on it and making it literally 3D, essentially.
Yeah, well, Terry Lynn's the big reason probably why I'm doing this. I mean, last 20 years or thereabouts, people have been trying to get me to do a Jack the Ripper play in some form or another, write it, direct it, or just be involved in it somehow. But I've sort of always resisted the temptation, basically because I was always worried that, you know, the story would somehow be corrupted and, you know, it just wouldn't come off the way I wanted to. I wanted to produce something, if I did, like, that was historically accurate, but still entertaining, of course, you know, because it is theater, after all. And Terry Lynn, actually, her and I were talking about it last year. She wanted me to maybe do a show with her. And we talked about it, and we thought, well, the 125th anniversary would be a better time to do it instead of the 124th. And we did apply to all the fringe festivals, and we only got into Vancouver. She pushed forward, and I said, okay, I'll do it. And originally, like, it was a much smaller project. It was going to be less characters involved. I was going to be less involved in terms of, like, I was just going to write it. And then she talked me into being part of it as an actor. And I haven't acted in a while, but I was game for it. And then my role sort of became even bigger, and it's become sort of an ensemble piece. And it's just sort of grown and evolved. And I thank Terry Lynn for that opportunity. I mean, she's really been the driving force and one of the reasons why I'm doing it. And having so much fun being out here in Vancouver doing it, because this is not my home. Being from Alberta, and I never thought I'd be staging something like that here. And it was kind of fascinating too that we had one of the descendants of one of the victims show up on the 125th anniversary of her death. Annie Chapman, one of her descendants, he's like a great 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 grand nephew of her, and he's Aaron Chapman. He's a musician and a writer, and he showed up, and that was fantastic. And I was even contacted today by another descendant who I've seen, like, in a documentary, and she's going to come to the show on Friday. And if I went to London and did this, I don't think I could get two descendants of the victims to show up.
But in Vancouver?
Yeah, because for me, like, I didn't want to create, like, a you know, sort of a horror show, or, you know, somebody jumping out saying boo. It's not really about the serial killer. I mean, Jack the Ripper is a serial killer, but, you know, I wanted to tell the victim story. I wanted there to be some humanity in this piece. I wanted there to show just basically the lives of the people in 1888, how they were living, you know, how they lived, how they died, all aspects of it. You know, I don't really shy away from any of it.
What are the, obviously, besides technology and the fact that we actually have indoor plumbing and all those types of things, which I'm very grateful for.
Yes.
So even though I said at the beginning of the show, I wouldn't mind going down and checking that stuff out, I'm very grateful we live where we live now. But what are some of the other differences, just even on a societal level, and just perception of prostitution, et cetera, back then?
Well, so on a societal level, I mean, there were quite a few differences. Women were marginalized, whether they were prostitute or not. I mean, they did not yet have the vote. When they became married, their property also became their husband's property, things like that. And if they had a marriage breakdown, or if they had a problem, there was no social safety net for them, unlike today. So if they found themselves, you know, in a desperate situation, there was really nothing they could do about it. There was no minimum wage. They either had to find a way to survive somehow. And that's why I use the term casual prostitute, because a lot of women in 1888, they were only prostituting themselves when they needed, like, money for a bed or money for a drink or money for food.
So it's more like survival. I see it as survival sex work.
Because they got any kind of job they could, whether it was sewing or cleaning or whatever they could. But oftentimes a woman in that period, like I said, once a marriage, for example, broke down and she was on her own,
mm-hmm.
She had to depend on herself. And if you're a 40-year-old woman, a factory owner, for example, he can find a 12-year-old girl at the time who can do your job a lot cheaper. And she's probably a lot quicker, too. And so, like I said, there was no minimum wage. There was no social safety net. There was really no place you could go for help. And so they had to survive the best way they could. And like I said, part of that involving having to sell themselves at times, and which is, you know, because all the victims led relatively normal lives up until sort of near the end. You know, most of them, you know, had marriages, they had relationships, most of them had children, most of them had, you know, some kind of common bond and common life before that fall from grace. And it was really only probably for the last, you know, 5 to 10 years of most of their lives that you saw this gradual decline. And that put them at risk for all kinds of things, like not only murder, but I mean, at the time, because of, you know, the problems, you know, we didn't even have ways to cure simple things like influenza, or we didn't have inoculations or things like that. So getting sick even at that time was something that was could be potentially lethal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people avoided the hospitals because that's where you went to die. You know, so don't go in the hospital, you won't come out type of thing.
Wow.
So, yeah, there were quite a few differences, but also quite a few similarities as well.
What are some of the similarities, like societal, like just concepts of how we view?
Yeah, I think some of those views are still prevalent today. I mean, you see women like that and you say, oh, well, why don't they get a job, or just why don't they stop using drugs, or why don't they just do that or do this?
And, mm-hmm.
When really it's a larger, more complex issue. And it just seems like, and a lot of people just want to keep them there as well. They want them, okay, like in 1888, London, yeah, let's just keep them in Whitechapel and Spitalfields and in the East End and in Vancouver, kind of the same thing, right? We just don't have them in our neighborhood. Let's just put them away where we don't have to look at them. And you know, maybe donate money every now and then to make yourself feel better, but not really trying to, you know, address the issues that, you know, are causing, like, the abuse or that high-risk behavior,
mm-hmm.
you know. And as you said, just putting those type of judgments or labels on somebody, like if they're an addict or a prostitute, and just labeling them that way, is those negative connotations that are still around today.
You've mentioned you've gone to other impoverished neighborhoods around the world, and is it similar to what Vancouver's like in that sense with the just perception, especially where there's prostitution?
I think it really depends on the city.
Okay.
I mean, some cities are much more open and accepting of it. I mean, for example, a city like Amsterdam is much more accepting of and tolerant in their red light district. But then again, they're a bit more tolerant on other issues as well, like drug addiction and drugs, for example. And so it's not always an issue in other cities in terms of perception.
Hmm.
You know, you're not looked down upon or treated differently or marginalized, let's say. But other cities which I haven't visited, I've heard they're much worse, though, like in repressive countries, right, like in third world countries or deeply religious countries. There's just no way you can even
escape
or even tell anyone, or you basically
mm-hmm.
you know have to hide. Like if you're a prostitute in a deeply religious country or a third world country, yeah, it's very hidden, it's very underground, it's And even then, I'm sure you're probably even more at risk because of it.
Yeah, because of the isolation. And just even one of the things I wanted to bring up as well, and we talked about a little bit in our pre-show chat, just about just perceptions. I almost call it the whore culture, which I hate using that word, but just even in Vancouver, just the cases, for example, of those girls getting attacked along the Cambie State Corridor in the last week and a half, which does scare me. All of them have been kind of alone at, like, you know, between 1 a.m. to about 3:30 a.m. for the three ladies. And thankfully, all of them were able to fight their attacker and get away. But it's still scary. And I almost think of it as almost like just where it's like, oh, she's out late. So it's almost like thinking of them in the same perception that sometimes people view prostitutes, where almost like easy in some way, shape, or form, even though that's not the case.
Yeah, it isn't the case. But as you said, those attitudes are still around. They're mm-hmm. still with us, you know, and they were with us 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, oftentimes it's that perception of, you know, somehow, like, not necessarily always blaming the victim, but did the victim contribute to it? And, you know, just being out at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, you shouldn't entitle anyone to, you know, try to, you know, get you in a car or harm you or attack mm-hmm. you in any way. And like, as you said, thankfully these women, you know, are okay. But, you know, it also makes you wonder, like, what if there's somebody missing right now? Like, that's what I've been thinking. Like, what if, you know, what if they're one that hasn't got away? You know, these are the type of things that go through my head, and that's the type of thing that bothers me, that we've heard about the three women that got away, but hopefully there hasn't been any other attacks that have been successful. That's what I really hope, and, you know, I hope the police catch them soon. You know, I mean, not that it makes the streets, like, completely safe, but,
no,
you know, but on the heels of something like Robert Picton, I mean, you know, the city doesn't need another, you know, case like that, or just even that kind of fear building again
mm-hmm.
With incidents like these, right?
Yeah, very much so. What do you think makes somebody turn into a serial killer? Like,
I really wish I knew.
Okay.
Boy,
in
yeah,
terms of a guesstimate.
I really do wish I knew, because I've seen so many backgrounds, and, you know, I think sometimes there are no paradigms when it comes to serial killers. You know, most of the information that you'll read nowadays about serial killers, unfortunately, comes from late 20th century American serial killers. And if you take a look at, let's say, pre-World War II serial killers, you tend to see a lot different killer oftentimes. You tend to see killers that sometimes are a bit more complex, that use different methods. Like, there was a man named Peter Kuerten, and he was operating in Dusseldorf in 1929, and he was attacking children, he was attacking couples, he was attacking women. He was doing it sometimes with a screwdriver, sometimes with a hammer, sometimes with a knife. And the police at the time thought they were dealing with three different attackers. They did not realize that it was just one man that was going around doing it all. And he was older, like, than your typical serial killer now, as a lot of pre-World War II serial killers seem to be. Just a little bit older than serial killers now. And oftentimes, I think it's also been shown that we can't really just blame things. Like, we can't just go around and say, oh, well, you know, video games are causing people to, you know, be serial killers, or it's comic books, or it's television, or mm-hmm. it's film. Because people like this existed before all these media were ever invented. And, you know, that's a real sobering thought. So if all these people were also around killing before there was television and this type of thing in video games, then, you know, it's coming from somewhere. And I've seen serial killers who had very normal families, seemingly normal upbringing. You know, when I saw Jeffrey Dahmer's parents once on television interviewed, and they were always profusely apologizing for their son, and they seemed like such a normal, happy couple. Like, and, you know, what went wrong with him? I don't know.
Yeah.
And what goes wrong with other people along the way? I just don't know. And also, you'll find people, let's say, of similar backgrounds as a serial killer that don't become serial killers, right? Just like your background, it doesn't determine who you are.
In terms of just violence against women, whether they be prostitutes or not, in terms of just, I almost call it slut shaming in terms of culture. Any advice or anything just for being safe and taking care of ourselves so we don't end up like Black Jet Dahlia or anything like that?
Yeah, I think the big thing that you should always do is just always listen to that first instinct, that gut reaction.
Okay.
Just never go away from that. You know, if something seems wrong, then trust that instinct no matter what. Try to just trust that. You know, if you don't want to walk down that street for whatever reason, don't walk down that street. You know, if it makes you feel safer to just go 10 minutes out of your way, do that 10 minutes out of your way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just try to do things like that. Just try to listen to yourself. Try to listen to that voice. I mean, there's no way to perfectly protect yourself, I think, in any real sense, but you know, just try to be aware of your surroundings and just listen to yourself, like, because sometimes, as you know, when you're with a person, like, they might seem fine, but you get a strange vibe.
Yes.
Sometimes that there's something wrong with this person, or you just get an odd feeling, and you should always listen, I think, to that little voice.
Very much so. I'm going to add a couple more things, too, sure. Just with social media these days. I think sometimes we forget that anybody can see where you are, so it's pretty easy to stalk someone, especially if you're using something like, just being really aware, like if you're using, say, Foursquare, for example,
right.
Where it's like, so-and-so just checked into Starbucks on Cambie in 22nd, or, you know, checked into UBC campus at this building. Just being really aware of that, being aware of what you post on Twitter. If you do have an open Facebook account, again, being really careful with your privacy settings. And sometimes people who do cause violence are sometimes people we know, which is pretty scary as well. And it's something we don't want to think about,
no,
but
that's very
good
advice, Caroline, because, yeah, you know, predators will use any information that, you know, that helps them. And as you said, social media is a good way to gather information nowadays. It's a good way for us to communicate as people, but predators know how to use the technology as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for anybody who is doing online dating or going out with somebody for the first time, there actually is a book that came out where it's just like, If I'm Dead. And basically where a woman who was going out with her abuser actually left a note for her sister, and her sister ended up writing a book, which a dear friend of mine had recommended because it was a really good depiction about violence and abuse based on a true story. But as well, even if it's a first time meeting somebody, let somebody know where you're going. It's so important to do that.
Always let somebody know where you're going. Try to go to a public place, you know,
mm-hmm.
where there are other people.
Being aware if somebody offers you a ride home as well, even if it's great and your feet hurt because you're wearing heels. So just to be safe. And that being said, and I know I've kind of redirected this towards females, but as men as well, it's so important, especially in a city like Vancouver. There's been a lot of men who have gone missing in the last few years,
sure.
who have literally disappeared. Some they have found in shallow graves at different spots, but there's a lot of other ones they haven't found.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's important for all people to be aware, because mm-hmm. anybody can be at risk.
Yes.
Yeah, because you don't know who the target is. I mean, you know, you don't know if you're a target
mm-hmm.
of somebody.
No, it's so true. So how do we basically as a society just not be freaking out all the time about the fact that somebody next to us could be a serial killer or, like, you know, thinking unholy thoughts about us.
True. Those are things, that keep people up at night.
Yeah.
Because I think those things make the news all of the time.
Mm.
But just generally, when you look statistically, murder is still relatively uncommon, especially in a place like Canada. And, you know, just statistically, your chances, you know, of being involved in anything like that is very, very remote. And, you know, I know it's not a comfort for a lot of people, but, you know, let's face it, you're much more likely to get into a car accident, you know, or something like that. You're much more likely, you know, to have 100 other things happen to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, that could cause death than murder. It's hard not to worry, but you also have to be aware. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you have to be aware, but but it's difficult. Like, I mean, if people worry, they're going to worry, and then the news always feeds that. I mean, you watch the first 10 minutes of news, it's never any good news. It's always bad news. You know, that old adage, if it bleeds, it leads, and they keep perpetuating it, and they feed into our fears, and so I often suggest, like, sometimes just take a break from the news every now and then, you know, like, read a book or do something else, and you know, because when I look out my window, you know, I don't see cop cars going down my street every day.
That's a good thing.
And things like that, yeah. You know, yeah. You know, I see it on the news. I see a lot of bad things on the news. And when I look out my window, nothing. So not to say it doesn't happen, because it does happen. We know it happens.
Yeah.
We know people that it's happened to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you should still live life and,
yeah,
and still enjoy life and not try to think of what might happen, but try to think of what you're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as you said, you know, you can be aware, and you can even minimize your own risks in life.
Yeah.
You know, not only for murder, but you can minimize your risks for almost anything, right?
That's true.
I mean, if I don't want to break my leg, I'm not going to go skiing. So, you know, I can minimize the risk of breaking a leg, for example, by doing that.
That's true.
You know.
Yeah, and I think being aware is a really big thing. Like you said, just really listen to that gut instinct. As well, even things like, for example, just being aware of how much time you're spending, say, checking your email or texting on when you're on the bus. It's great to do that if you're on for a long ride, but maybe take a look around and just see who else is on there with you.
Who else is on the bus? Yeah. And what if it's you and some other creep, and he's not getting off, and you're worried that you got to get off at that second last stop?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because the last thing you want is to be followed, because it's better to go a little bit further out of your way, like you said, that extra 10 minutes,
right,
if it means a little bit more safety.
If it does, you know, if it makes, and if also if it makes you feel safe, you should do it.
Yeah. Which is so key.
Yeah.
Yeah, and last but not least, the Vancouver Police Department did recommend as well, just making sure if you have your headset on, make sure you don't have it on when you're walking, and try to avoid dark alleys, and just...
Absolutely.
And trying to walk in the middle of the sidewalk. So,
yeah, that's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting one. So
yeah.
Yeah,
because if you're in the middle of the sidewalk, then, yeah, people behind bushes or behind other objects, or, you know, it's harder for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You maybe at least see them, or you're further away.
That's so true.
You know, you're not as easy to grab, for example.
Very much so. Yeah, so what's next for you? Because you've got the show. It wraps next Sunday.
Do you have the show? Not quite sure in the immediate short term, but I do have to be in London in November. So, and we're also hoping the show has a little bit of legs and that maybe we can tour it or do something else with it. So we would really like that, Terry Lynn and I, to do something more with the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope so, because that'd be, I think it's very important stuff to see.
It is. Mm-hmm. People will get a charge of the show. They'll like the show, and it's not for everybody. I'll grant you that. But you know, some people should not see the show. If you're really really sensitive type, you should not see the show. But
okay,
for most people, it's generally okay. Listeners of your show would probably be
sure. Anybody who can listen to CITR after 10 p.m.
Okay. So.
In perfect world, if this got picked up and you were able to go on tour with the show, where would some of the key places that you think you'd love to have almost like a community talk back afterwards? Like, what type of conversation would you like to have with the audience? You know how it's after some theater places?
Yeah, exactly. They have a talk back with the audience. Mm-hmm. And Terry Lynn and I were at one not too long ago at the Farnsworth Invention. And there was a talk back after the show with the cast and also an expert from UBC, and the director was there as well. And it was quite informative, and I like talk backs, and that would be something I would really love to do with the show. It's something you can't really do at the Fringe, because there's always like another show coming on after you. But you know, it's something that would be very, very helpful. The audiences really like it, because when I spoke at the library, for example, last week, it was... It was a 90-minute talk, but it could have gone on much longer. We had to wrap it because, for reasons like, we'll have to wrap this radio show as well, because there are time constraints, but it's a talk that could have gone on a lot longer. And, but yeah, it's something that you could do a talk back really in any city that you performed a play like this. I think the audiences would probably have like a lot of interesting questions.
I was just going to ask, what's the most unusual question you've gotten since people found out that you're a ripperologist?
Oh, wow. That's really putting me on the spot.
I figure you probably, or let's say the top three, and what are the answers?
God, I don't know if I can even come up with one.
Okay.
But I suppose like the most common one is like, how do you become a ripperologist? You know, just sort of like even like how does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's just sort of one of those things that if you do something long enough and, you know, you start researching and writing about it and publishing about it, I think, you know, you become accepted as an expert on it.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like any subject, I think. But generally, I don't get a lot of weird questions, thankfully.
In terms of the Ripper, if you could actually meet him and interview him, what would be the three questions you'd ask?
Three questions I would ask. I would definitely want to know about his childhood.
Okay.
I would want to know who his first victim was.
Hmm.
And I'd want to know why he stopped. Why there were seemingly no murders after 1888.
That's true.
But yeah, I definitely want to know who he started with. Might be something that surprises us all. And just by knowing his background would be absolutely fascinating to know, like, you know, where he grew up or, you know, what his parents did, you know, what he did, what he was exposed to. Those are the questions I would be most interested in.
One weird thought. Have you ever thought it might be a female?
No.
And why?
Personally, because all of the victims were seen with men. In the cases where there are witnesses, they were all seen in the company of men shortly before their murder. None of them were seen in the company of women. And also, women tend not to slice people up like that, strangle and slice. That tends to be a almost exclusively masculine thing. Especially in the 1800s. Many female poisoners, though.
Interesting.
Yeah, poison's sort of a female thing, especially in Victorian times. But if a woman did decide to do that, especially in Victorian London, she'd have the same chances as a man of probably getting away. But like I said, for the reasons I just exposed, I don't think it's even worthy of consideration. Yeah.
Wow.
And I think it's also even a personal insult almost to women on a level that here's women being slaughtered by a man, but, you know, now you're trying to, like, at least in a couple books, trying to blame it on a woman, you know, which I think just seems like a further blow, you know, against, you know, the gender.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I always am curious about that. I know most of the documented cases of serial killers that I've heard of have usually been men, and the only one I know is the one that Charlize Theron played.
Eileen Wuornos.
Yes.
Yeah, and she used a gun.
Yeah, so it's a different method.
Yeah, but yeah, she's an interesting case unto herself, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Caroline. I really enjoyed being here and talking about it.
Likewise, we'll have to have you on again.
I'd love to be on again talking about really anything.
Cool. We will have to have you then.
Sure.
And for those of you who I highly recommend, if you're just tuning in now, Jack the Ripper, Vancouver East Cultural Center, and it does wrap this Sunday. It's part of the Vancouver International Friends Festival. And with that, you can get tickets at vancouverfringe.ca. And for them, if anybody wants to book you directly for a lecture or contact you, what's the best way to reach you?
I'm easily reached through places like Facebook. I mean, people can message me through Facebook or Yeah, or I could even leave an email here at the studio.
Sure.
If you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.
Yay.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Up next is Hans von Klaus's Misery Hour. He is a very sexy man to be miserable with. He'll be guiding you through the wee hours with his awesome music. And if you could see him, he always has the best shoes. So I wish I had a shoe collection except the female version of it. So so that is coming up next. And I'm just going to encourage everybody, please, please, please support local theater. Come check out all the amazing shows at the Fringe, especially Jack the River. But as well as that, there's, I believe, over 80 shows. There's supposed to be 600 performances altogether. And it's really exciting. So there's performers from all around the world. And I think it's really important. You can see all sorts of different shows. And my guest that I had on last week was saying that when she did the Fringe in Winnipeg, that people actually take an entire 2 weeks off of work to go to their Fringe. And I'd love to see a little bit of that camaraderie here, where it's that type of degree of supporting local theater and just checking stuff out would be pretty amazing. So I'm going to challenge you to that. So how many Fringe shows in how many days? And it would be really great. The 15th is coming up next Sunday, so please check stuff out, but especially check out Jack the Ripper. And as well as that, check out Robert McLaughlin's am I saying your name correctly?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Okay. Robert McLaughlin's your book as well.
First Jack the Ripper victim photographs, but unfortunately it's out of print, but hey, there might be a second printing sometime. So.
Which might be cool. No. So we may need to have him back on and start an Indiegogo campaign or something to raise some money to do that.
Sure.
Could be chapter 3. So until next time, everyone, have an amazing night. Bye-bye, and be safe, both sexually and otherwise.
The glass, we might as well rejoice in random chance and take our pleasure while